This your boy Jay Gibson, CEO and founder of Rethink Rich Academy, the new face of finance. Get used to it. And it's another edition of Late Night Boss Talk. Tonight, we got some boss talk, but we're talking GOAT talk. Is Jordan really the greatest of all time? We'll get to it. I know you like, what? Just stick around. I'll break it down. Time for the Wolfpack to ride. Let's get with it. Ow! Is Jordan really the greatest of all time? I mean, some people think it's blasphemy to even ask that question. But as I sat back and I studied each and every part of the Last Dance documentary, which, by, you know, just give them the Emmys already. You know, they're going to rack up all the Emmys for sports documentaries. And they've done a beautiful job of laying out their case. You know, this is not just about the run of the Bulls, you know, so to speak. It's also a validation, a final coronation of Michael Jordan as the greatest of all time. It's very peculiar, you know, that this dropped. Now, this was all planned well before the pandemic, but you have to remember, at this time right now, LeBron would be on his run for a championship. And this documentary would still have dropped. Now, I don't know if they would have dropped it exactly right in the middle of, you know, getting in the ramp up to the NBA Finals. But if you think about it, this was already scheduled. They didn't move it up, even though everything was shut down in March. They still kept their timeline. So you have to give them credit for saying, hey, you know, we're going to put this out when we're going to put it out. But this would be basically a week or two before the finals. You know, we would be looking at the Eastern Conference and Western Conference finals matchups right now. And it would be obvious that with LeBron going for his fourth ring at that point, but the first time anybody who's ever won three rings with three different teams, there would be a, you know, there's no way getting around that argument, that people would have a legitimate argument that, hey, even though, you know, MJ did win six and all of that, but no one has went to three different teams and done it. And so you would have a valid argument. You still may get that chance over the summer, but with everything going on with this season, people are already, you know, throwing shade, talking about, oh, this season will have an asterisk on it. Well, what about the 50 game seasons? And what about, you know, during the NBA lockouts and stuff like that? Somebody had to win a ring during those years. And so, like I said, I think, you know, first off, let me just address the documentary. The documentary was great. You know, I agree with everything that was laid out in it? No, we'll get into some of those things as we go on. I think certain people were painted, you know, in a poor light. But I also think that certain things were revealed that we all didn't know because this is the inside scoop. And I'm also going to show how this relates to business. There's a lot of business lessons that can be learned from this. When you're talking about leadership and you're also talking about, you know, constructing a team, team management, staff, personnel, you know, the difference between management and the actual employees, which in this case are the players. You know, and we'll get into those things, but I want to start off with this. Now, people may say, you know, how can you, you know, come on, man, you just hating. It's no way, you know, oh, I'm just turning this off. Michael Jordan, the greatest of all time. But I want you to think about this. They said repeatedly throughout the documentary how Magic Johnson and Larry Bird saved the NBA in the 80s, which they did. The NBA, if you look up the numbers, was in rapid decline. Most teams, you know, like I said, they want a tape delay, meaning that they would play the games like after the primetime shows. They weren't showing live games. And so it just wasn't a box office draw. And, you know, the rivalry of the Lakers and the Celtics in the 1980s definitely, you know, brought the attention the NBA needed. And then just, you know, for the fact that we live in America, I mean, you have Larry Bird, who was one of the greatest players. I don't care, you know, what ethnicity he is, but he was from Boston. You know, he's not from Boston. He's from Indiana, but played for the Boston Celtics. You know, they were a great team at the time. And then you had Magic Johnson, you know, who's African-American. He's playing for the Showtime Lakers. So it was almost like a prize fight that we got to watch every year. I mean, I was super, super young when that whole thing was going on. So I don't remember most of it, but I do remember, you know, Larry Bird in his latter years and Magic kind of on the back end of his prime. So, you know, I can see how, you know, the NBA as a product, was saved by that rivalry, right? It drew interest. Then Michael Jordan came in the mid-80s, and so it was like a changing of the guard, but it took a few years. It's not like the minute, MJ hit the league, I mean, everybody just bowed down to MJ. I mean, he had to, basically get through the ranks, and that's what I mean. When you really break it down, you have to look at it as, those early Bulls teams, and they did a great job of showing that. I mean, that was the culture of the NBA at that time. Players, drinking before the games, players smoking at halftime, players getting high in between. I knew somebody who was the son of Michael Ray Richardson, and he was a player from the 80s who had a lot of, drug problems and stuff like that. And his son told a lot of stories. I won't tell them here, but there's some stories about some of your greatest sports heroes that you may not want to hear. But everybody's image isn't as squeaky clean as you think. So I would just say to you that we have to understand that the importance of Michael Jordan being the not only the best player in the NBA, but the best player in the world. And how a lot of stars lined up for him, and a lot of things kind of fell into place. Now, if you look at Michael Jordan, like I said, those early years, those Bulls teams, as a team and organization, they weren't really ready for prime time. They didn't have the, the players. They basically just was running off Jordan. Jordan, was a sensation. He won the dunk contest. He won the scoring titles. But the knock on him early was the same that was on LeBron, that he couldn't win a championship, right? And so when you think about it, you told, like we just mentioned, the Celtics, we mentioned the Lakers. They also were the 76ers. That was before my time. I mean, that's early 80s with Dr. J and those guys. But nobody won a title on their own. So this whole argument that, one player can, beat five people playing as a unit, it's just not reality. So I think that we have to examine that and be objective when we say that we saw his early struggles. Then the Bulls, when they finally did, they drafted Scottie, and that's what I'll get into when I talk about management versus employees and the friction there. But sometimes it works in perfect, it's like organized chaos. So, the early couple of episodes of The Last Dance, they totally clown the GM, which was Jerry Krause. He's a little short guy, and people basically compared him to the Penguin off the old Batman movies when Danny DeVito played the Penguin. I mean, he's just a short, shrimpy, nerdy looking guy, and it was easy to kind of pick on him and say, hey, he was the Rat Fink of the crew, and he just, excuse me, he was jealous because he couldn't be part of the crew and the inner circle, and so he wanted to break up the party. But he couldn't have done any of that without the permission of the owner, right? And so we have to look at that, and we have to say, okay, was he just the middleman? Was he the spokesperson that was speaking on behalf of ownership? And a lot of times, the general manager, he puts together the team, he deals with the salaries, he has to, deal with the coach, and and deal with the business end of running the team. The coach end, deals with the performance of the players. And then ownership, sits at the table and basically gets all the credit, right? But very rarely gets the blame. Now, like I'm saying to you, Jerry Krause was instrumental because even though we didn't like him, he's an easy villain. And sometimes he probably did do some things that made him unlikable. But at that era, management was, even in this era, management has to have a buffer between them and the players, or else that. You feel like, that this guy is Michael Jordan is the biggest star in the world, and he's just running the show. He runs the team, and he tells them what to do. And you just, as an effective leader and manager, you can't have that. You have to assert yourself and assert your leadership, and you have to give credit where credit is due. That management staff, put together an excellent cast, and that cast—that's the key word, cast—because everybody had a role to play, and. When you really look at it, Michael Jordan did not win anything, not even a playoff series, until they started putting pieces around him, which is what frames my argument right now. So, like I said, he was smart enough to pull off a trade and get Scottie Pippen. I believe in the same draft they got Horace Grant. So they got two key pieces right there that were part of that early run. And then along came the other pieces like Paxson, and some of the role players. And so We saw in the second half run, they had Steve Kerr, they added Dennis Rodman. And so this is what I'm trying to get you guys to understand. Until they were a unit, even in the early days of them putting together that unit with Horace Grant and Scottie, that wasn't enough to beat the Pistons. The Pistons were a seasoned veteran team. They were called the Bad Boys for a reason. They basically played hard, street ball style, right? To the point where, I mean, you didn't know if you were watching, Saturday night main event, with Hulk Hogan, or you were watching a basketball game. But that style of tough, rough defense and physicality is what got them their championships, and they were able to win back-to-back championships. And so there was kind of a passing of the torch. So MJ had to get over these hurdles. He didn't have it all from day one. But when we talk about the Bulls and Michael Jordan, we like to romanticize it and say he just, from the time he jumped out the womb, he was dunking the basketball, he was the greatest of all time. So we have to show his evolution in the same light that we show LeBron's. And this is not an MJ versus LeBron podcast, but I'm saying that to say this. I see a lot of a lot of I like to say amnesia out here. A lot of the sports writers who always doubt LeBron as the greatest of all time are saying it in the context of them being covering, Michael Jordan, and them being there to witness a lot of this, and that's their era. So to them, that's the best they ever saw, the excellence. And I will say, when you talk about competitiveness, he probably was the most competitive player of all time. I will give him that. His skill was actually his ability to do whatever it took to be the best. That doesn't necessarily, it will make you the best at that moment, but to say someone's the best of all time, when you look at people like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and you look at people like Wilt Chamberlain and all these guys that came before him, right? Bill Russell, I believe, has like 10 rings. So if we're going to base this thing off of rings, nobody has more rings than Bill Russell, right? Now, he played at a time when he was like the only black guy in the NBA, but that's not his fault. Same way Michael Jordan played at a time where, yes, they were good athletes, but they were not on the level of Michael Jordan, right? The whole notion of having your own personal trainer, and Tim Grover, who was his trainer, he has his own book called Relentless. You guys should check that out because it tells the whole story. He trained MJ and then went on to train Kobe. So you can see the results right there just with those two clients. But what I'm saying is there was a lot that went into Michael Jordan being positioned. Now, like I said, they won the first two rings. They finally got past the Pistons. They played the Lakers. Now, when they played the Lakers for the first championship, I mean, let's just be honest. That was not Magic Johnson in his prime. It just wasn't. And I know people gonna say, "Oh, he's a hater. He's hating." It's not, man. Stop it. Let's look at we just watched the tape. That was an old Magic Johnson as an old Lakers team that was dominant in their era and as it was at the end of their run. So to sit there and say he went through the toughest competition, to be honest, those last two championships against Utah was more competition, if you want to say that, because some of those other teams, I mean, he had the second ring. I think they played against the Trailblazers and Clyde Drexler. Clyde Drexler was on his last set of knees. I mean, let's just be honest. There was no more glide in Clyde the Glide. He was just sliding. He wasn't gliding. So you have to be honest, man. The Bulls were the team on the future. They were the team on the rise. They had the young stallions. And a lot of these Western, conference teams were like past their prime, the old stars. And so that's what I'm saying to you, not taking anything away from, their ability to win a championship, because it takes a lot to win a championship. And it doesn't, you can't pick who your opponent is. So I'm not saying that, they had to play whoever was on the floor. But in the same light that Golden State won all those championships and the Eastern Conference, wasn't as strong as it was in the 90s, and then even when LeBron was playing him, he was playing with a bunch of, fill-in players. He didn't really have the strong units that he had in the Miami run. So therefore, that was a whole different animal when you talk about the dominance and then the momentum and the confidence that's built off of that. So like I said, the first two rings, kind of were against the old stars. Then you go into the Olympics in 1992, and this is where we start seeing the positioning. Now, like I said, had Michael Jordan earned the spotlight at that time? Absolutely. But what I'm talking about is people forget that, Michael Jordan was an ambassador for Nike. He basically was more than a sponsored athlete. He was their global ambassador. So the Olympics was, a global stage. And that's why you see the big, 5, 6, 10 foot story billboard of Michael Jordan in Barcelona, and every press organization in the world is there. I mean, that's just part of history, them putting him that big on a building. And all of that came with that, right? The whole signaling and marketing of that. They had the Gatorade commercials, If I Could Be Like Mike. You had all of the marketing that went into the Nike phenomenon and the cultural phenomenon that the Jordan shoe had, the impact that it had on America and around the world. So that was its own animal. That shoe was just a beautiful shoe. Still to this day, the artistic styling and the fashion aspect of that shoe supersedes, Michael Jordan as a player. But it definitely matched his brand. I will tell you that. So if his brand was being, the forefront of the NBA, the future of the NBA, the best player, he has the best shoe, and they marketed using Spike Lee to do his early commercials. It's gotta be the shoes, gotta be the shoes, gotta be the shoes. Made me and every other kid in the world, black, white, or green, want those shoes. And then, the price point of them, they were a luxury item. I mean, to pay $100, $125. I remember the first pair of Jordans were like $50, $60. And I remember my mother going to the store saying, $50, $60 for a pair of sneakers. I mean, it was ridiculous at that time. And I was like 84, 85. So, to get those sneakers, meant something. So then by the time the Jordan 3s came out, they were about $100, and then they went to 125. And at that time, that was a lot of money, to pay for a sneaker. Now we're talking 250 and up. Some of these shoes, the prices are, what you would pay for a rent in an apartment somewhere. And so it's become its own phenomenon. So I want to separate the Jordan mystique from the Jordan and Nike marketing, even though Jordan was the face of the marketing. You have to understand Jordan the player, Jordan the marketing, it all kind of propelled into him taking this image. Now, I want to draw a correlation, right? I want to show you how, in my view, just to kind of put it the same frame of reference, Notorious B.I.G., right? And I know, see, here you go again. Oh, don't tell me you're going to diss Big. I'm not dissing anybody. What I'm saying is, when Biggie tragically was killed, Diddy and the whole marketing of Biggie as the greatest rapper of all time, for somebody who had just dropped their second album, to say they were the greatest rapper of all time when you had Rakim, you had Nas, who was in his prime at that time as well. You had, just people in general of that time who were, talented and known, Big Daddy Kane. I mean, you had a bunch of lyricists that were out there. And so, we don't have to go too far down the list to say that there's a valid argument to say, well, is he the greatest rapper of all time? So I'm saying it in the frame of reference of that. Michael Jordan, the marketing put behind him, and the whole cultural shift that happened in the 90s. You had black excellence, basically, for since the James Brown era, which I wasn't alive to see. That was the next wave of black excellence. I mean, you had the number one show on TV was The Cosby Show. You had Mike Tyson knocking out everybody in 30 seconds. You had Michael Jordan, the biggest star in the world. You had Denzel Washington and Wesley Snipes and all these people, the biggest movie stars in the world. So, black excellence was on display at its finest during the 90s. I mean, all the TV shows, The Martin, The Living Color. I mean, it was everywhere. Right, it was just black expression, black culture, black creativity, and black excellence. We were doing everything at the highest level. Everywhere you looked, we were the biggest movie, the music stars. I mean, how could I forget Michael Jackson? I mean, in the 80s and 90s, it was ridiculous, right? It's that's what I'm saying to you. We have to understand the era that this stuff took place. So that leads me to the next point of greatest of all time. When you make that statement, that's saying anybody before him or anybody but after him, he's still better than them. How can you say that when this time is still moving? Players have evolved, athletics has evolved, training has evolved, the bodies of these guys, you know what I'm saying? Somebody like a LeBron James was basically Karl Malone with more athleticism. So this is what I'm saying to you guys. You can't, it's just to say that has nothing to do with Jordan. Was he the greatest of his time? Yes. So before you start, sending me hate mail and death threats, you understand what I'm saying? He was the greatest of his time. Right? But you could say, okay, was Kareem the greatest of his time? That was the era of the center, right? Was LeBron or Kobe? Now, that's a real argument because they shared some of time within the same era, even though Kobe was about 3 or 4 years, maybe even 5 years before LeBron hit the scene. As far as their prominence and their dominance, I mean, obviously, I was what, like a senior in high school? Kobe's about a year older. To watch him, do his thing, was phenomenal. Now, LeBron didn't hit the scene, I believe, until what, 2003, something like that. So, Kobe was kind of on the back half of his career when LeBron started his. But what I'm saying is, as far as winning the championships and being considered one of the greatest, LeBron was thrust into that from day one. But that's a better argument as far as if you want to say who was the best, of that particular era. Because are you going to mark the Kobe and Shaq era as one separate thing and then start from the 2000s with LeBron and them? You could do that and say, okay, obviously Kobe was the best of his era. LeBron is basically undeniably the best of his era. So everybody is the best player in their era. They can only play against the players who were alive to play during that time. So this, and I believe Michael Jordan has even said that himself. Like that's like saying Babe Ruth is the best of all time. Really wasn't any black players in the in Major League Baseball at the time. They were in the Negro Leagues. So if he had to play against the Negro League players, would he still be considered the best of all time? Elvis is considered the king of rock and roll. But we know, he's covered basically took songs and dance moves and everything else from some of the, black artists at the time who didn't get the recognition. And it's not a racial thing. It's just a cultural thing. It's just a fact. That these people, were elevated, but they didn't have the competition that, have the obstacles that some other people had. So when we're talking about sports, it's very subjective because people, are going to have nostalgia and reminisce on the memories. I was a Bulls fan in the 90s. I mean, then also, was a Knicks fan as well. So I know you say, well, how were you Bulls fan, Knicks fan? Early 90s. Bulls fan, then we got to the mid 90s, you couldn't deny the Knicks and what they were bringing to the table. So, that was, and just being from New York, everybody in New York was rooting for the Knicks. And if it wasn't for Patrick Ewing and that stupid finger roll, we probably would have had a championship. Well, Mike took a break. All right. We knew we had a short window and Ewing had to go up there and do that stupid finger roll, right? So, that's that, but that's my own sour grapes. But back to Mike. So, like I'm saying to you, do I think he's the best of his era? Yes. Now let's get back to the boss talk as far as his marketing and his positioning. So, like I said, after the Olympics, I mean it was just a runaway train at that point. Then you had the third championship, you had the Space Jam movie, that kind of he was like the first, basketball player to have a major movie, Looney Tunes and all this stuff that was going on. So that blew up and was just a huge success. And then you had the McDonald's endorsements, the Gatorade commercials, and like I said, the Jordan brand itself just growing and growing and growing. And so then he kind of took the hiatus. We all know that. I won't even get into that. With the gambling and stuff. Do I believe there's more to the story than what they're talking about? Obviously, but I want to talk about, as I said, the elements of this thing. So you have the value of the team. And like I said, Michael did not win any championships before they put the right team around him. He needed people like Horace Grant, who was gonna, take the charges and get the rebounds and do his part. He needed Pippen, he needed a Robin to his Batman, and that is key. When you're in business, you can be the best person in the world at one thing. But to really win consistently and win at a high level, you need a team. So whether you're the CEO, whether you're the director of marketing and you have a good team under you, whether you're talking about a sales team, you have the guys who can close, you have the guys who are, good with, sitting there listening to every problem the client has and building that rapport and showing empathy. And that has a lot to do with your not just your personality, but your values and what type of perspective you bring to the table. And so that's what I want to focus on as far as when we're talking about this. So what I will say he was great at getting the best and demanding excellence from everybody around him. And he led by example. So on one hand, while I'm saying, the hype and the marketing, he lived up to the hype, right? So I will say that, but what I'm also saying that allowed him to be the unquestioned leader of the group, but he would lead by example. His example was, I'm going to keep working at something until I'm the best at it. So I'll give you an example of that when he started winning Defensive Player of the Year and making first team all defense, he realized early on that offense wasn't just going to get it. If he wanted to be truly the best player in the league, he had to be the best on offense and defense. And that's something that I will give him his credit for. That's if you want to say he's the best two-way player of all time, right? So there's a difference. There's different lanes and different variations of players. I mean, you have so many different types of skills when you're talking about athletes that to just say they're the greatest at everything. Was he the greatest three-point shooter of all time? Is he the greatest free throw player of all time? Is he the greatest rebounder of all time? There's so many aspects to the game. Let me get a sip here. Talking about Mike got me hyped. You know what I'm saying? I had to take a little water break. But what I'm saying to you guys, there's so many aspects to the game. A lot of people don't think about that. So, like I said, all around he had the most tenacity and the most competitiveness. But then let's look at that as well. His competitiveness sometimes could be a wedge between him and some of the teammates because he had to learn, as you saw in some of the documentaries when we got to 5, 6, and 7, and 8, he had to trust his teammates. So even the greatest player, if we're going to accept that he's the greatest player of all time, we have to also accept that he was able to understand the importance of having teammates he can rely on and then making them feel important and part of the process. If it was all Michael Jordan all the time, another team can game plan for that. And you started seeing them double teaming them and setting up certain schemes just to stop him, forcing the rest of the team to do it. Now, he had to learn how to trust other people. He had to trust Phil Jackson that he was going to put together a system that was going to benefit him because they talked about that early in the documentary as well. As like the early coaches, they were all about give him the ball, give him the ball. It's all about Mike. And then when Phil Jackson came in, he kind of said, hey, you have to share the ball. For us to truly be great and for us to win a championship, you cannot be the only offensive weapon. And he put in what is called the triangle offense. Now, one great thing I did learn from the documentary that Phil Jackson didn't even create the triangle offense. It was some guy named Tex that would, that once again, Jerry Krause brung to the table to work with Phil. Because what people don't understand, even Phil Jackson, the great Google, who is considered the greatest coach of all time, and we'll touch on that when we talk about Mike as well. Until he got the right leader, he was not able to tap into his full potential. Those early coaches, they might have meant well, they probably are talented. A lot of them, got other coaching, jobs down the line and had success in other parts of their career. But at that time, they were not able to, get the most out of Mike because he was only focused on one part of his game, which was mostly doing dunks and scoring and becoming a superstar, making a poster out of somebody every night. So, like I said, those guys didn't have the cerebral capability to get everybody on the same page. Now, when you talk about Phil Jackson, that is very key because Phil Jackson has a different approach than most leaders. He's able to tap into what you care about most and show you how that being a part of the group will basically serve that interest. It's in your best interest to do that. So whether it was, Dennis Rodman out there wilding, being a wild child, to Pippen feeling underappreciated, to being the fact that he won some titles with the Knicks, so he brought some championship experience. Mike had to respect that because, yes, Mike had won in college, but he hadn't won anything in the pros. And this guy has won a couple rings in the pros. So, yay, those Knicks teams in the 70s were nothing to sneeze at. And so this was a guy that had respect from day one because he had something Mike never had, which is a championship, and that's key. So Phil's leadership style wasn't, he wasn't a dictator, but he commanded respect. And he knew when to, basically, when to, when to drill, when to push, and when to, and when to lay back. And that's key. You have to know when to hit the gas and when to hit the brake, right? And so he was able to give the guys rest when they needed rest. At that point, by the time they won a couple of rings, those guys were, they were veterans. They didn't need to, grind it and practice every single day, every single minute. He knew when to give him a day off. He knew with Rodman, if we didn't let him go, to Vegas for a couple of days, we wouldn't get him to perform. And so, he basically saw the tension. So they let him go out and do his thing. So now he has no excuse not to give 110% to the team. He knew Scottie was a good player, but Scottie was kind of in Mike's shadow. So he had to find a way to keep Scottie involved. And make him feel important because he was the co-star. And in many ways, Scottie in his prime felt like he could have went to another team and been just as big, even though there were flaws in some Scottie's personality. And that's a big difference when you talk about him and Mike. They both were talented players, and as a combination, that may be the greatest duo of all time. Even though Shaq and Kobe probably would have been able to surpass them had they been able to keep that group together. So once again, you have to credit the management and the coaching staff who was able to keep all these stars. Another key aspect when we're talking about management is the contracts, the salaries. Michael Jordan's salary from the Bulls was far less than what he made in endorsements. So even though he was paid well, and towards the back end of his career, he really cashed in for all the years that they kind of made money off him. You have to look at that whole roster. He had Pippen almost his whole career on his first contract. I mean, he signed a horrible contract. And they blamed Scottie and they said, well, who was his agent at the time? You know what I mean? So those are things that you have to understand. And all of that played a role. Keeping all those guys on those low wage deals allowed them to get so much more bang for the buck. Had they had, and you notice that the team was broken up once it was time to pay up. And the owner just didn't want to pay the premium that it would cost to keep all those guys together even for one more year. He was a penny pincher in my view, and he just was a mean guy. He didn't have vision. He was so focused on the numbers that he didn't care about, the legacy and what these guys and what it stood for. And I believe that's the reason you didn't see the Bulls win any more championships since Michael Jordan left, which makes him even more of a legend. Because it's not like they came through and won more titles as the years went on. Once Phil and Michael walked out the door, so did the titles. And you have to look at that. So they were able to keep those groups together because of the contracts and the way those teams were constructed on the business side. And never forget that, sports is a business. Professional sports is a business. And, that plays into some of the teams' makeups and how, same thing with the Warriors, that those guys had a lot of guys on those rookie deals. And, and they paid, obviously, Steph Curry got paid a boatload of money and everybody along the way, but they had to reshape some of those groups to balance out, the salaries. So it's easy to win when you got some of the youngest, best talent on a minimum deal. But when it's time to pay up and you have to manage these salaries, even though they were making, I mean, oodles and oodles of money. The owner still felt like, that was too expensive. They couldn't carry that because you do have a salary cap, in the league, and it's only so much, and then you have to pay a tax But I mean, when you're looking at coming back for a seventh year, I mean, come on, man. I mean, a seventh title. I mean, come on. I mean, whatever it would have costed, they would have made that times 10 for them to win seven rings. And then you could easily say, okay, now we shutting it down. Oh, we're gonna can we win eight? Can we win nine? I mean, Michael Jordan was tired at that point. You know, he would have risked not being in his prime. I think you saw a lot of those old guys from the 80s play past their primes, and then they just didn't have the value. And he remember him being a winner, him being the best, was uniquely tied to his brand. So, his willingness to be able to retire, we have to look at that too. He had almost a 2-year break in the middle of his career. Now, we can get into the gambling stuff, we can get into the rumors and all of that, but the point is, he was able to take a 2-year break. There's no other NBA superstar that is even on the list of greatest of all time that got a break in the middle of their prime and was able to come back fresh, and with a team that was still constructed to their strengths and come back and make a run for another couple titles. Now, that's not to say winning these titles was easy, but there was a lot of factors involved with, Mike's success, and we cannot ignore that. So I just wanted to point those things out. But I want to give, like I said, the directors, ESPN, all the sports commentators, and all the content that has been going on the past 5 weeks are built around this thing. Do I think, that we have to look at some of those things, like I said, whether it was the management styles, whether it was the contracts, whether it was the competition, everything was kind of the table was set for Michael for a lion to come in and just hunt. And that's exactly what he did. So like I'm saying to you, you have to consider those things. Now, the average sports fan, they're not going to care. But when we're talking about, boss talk, these are lessons that you guys can learn. So if you could put a group together, that would you're not overburdened with the salary, and you can have a great product and get it out there, you can most importantly have a great leader that can put that group together and manage those personalities and get the most out of everybody to make them give a damn about the group, right? Instead of just themselves, you can win. And that's the lesson of tonight. Don't worry about, no matter how great you are individually, you're only as strong as your unit, and your leadership. And I think that's the lesson you have to take from the Last Dance documentaries, that this is should really be taught in business schools when you're talking about Phil Jackson's coaching style and how he was able to keep a team and the general managers while he was the GOAT. When I say the GOAT, not in a good way, he was the heel, and the joker of the documentary and of that time. The man brought in all the great plays. He put the teams together. He recruited Phil Jackson from the Puerto Rican leagues, which was hilarious, just watching him down there coaching in the Puerto Rican leagues back in the day. To bringing him in the NBA and then eventually replacing the head coach with him, and then putting that guy Tex that had that offense since the 60s, and him being able to study it and master it and then put his own stamp on it. So he had a playbook, he had the mentality, and then he got the opportunity. And those are three things I think were totally underestimated before this documentary came out. So being that, Phil Jackson was able to go to the Lakers and win more rings. You know what I'm saying? So he was able to, carry that championship DNA to a whole nother organization. Michael Jordan clearly stated in the documentary, in his own words, he didn't want to play for any other coach but Phil Jackson. He didn't want to do a rebuild. I mean, come on now. LeBron took so many teams that were full of spare parts to the finals. It's ridiculous. So you have to look at that. I'm not sitting here, saying LeBron has certain things in his game that MJ doesn't have, but MJ has that. I think LeBron's tenacity and his killer instinct, so to speak, kicked in later on, in his career once he got the confidence of those first couple championships. And the fact that LeBron never played college ball. MJ played for 3 years and was able to win a couple of NCAA titles. So I think, that's something that you have to think about. He had a taste for winning. He was brought up in a program, that was the best in the country at that time, and still to this day, North Carolina has one of the best programs in the country. And it's ran better than some NBA teams, just to be real. But I'm saying to you guys, that experience that he came into the league with, LeBron had to learn on his own, and so I think that we have to understand, yes, MJ was the greatest of his era, was the most competitive person probably to ever play, especially in the NBA, if not all the team sports. I mean, we haven't looked at every single other athlete to see how competitive they were, but he's definitely on the Mount Rushmore of athletes because he won, and he won at a high level, and he was willing to do whatever he had to do to get the job done. And so you can see him get emotional when he talked about that, because he, like he said, he never asked anybody to do anything he wasn't willing to do. And he put a few choice words that I won't use on this podcast, but he did, and that's the whole thing. You can't ask people to do things you're not willing to do. So if you want people to go the extra mile, you need to go too. If you want people to, stay later and make phone calls, be willing to get on that phone and make those calls yourself. Get your hands dirty. Your team, that's just like whether it's in the military or whatever, we're in this foxhole together and you're not shooting with me and you're just barking out orders. I mean, people lose respect for that. And so in order for people to really follow you, you have to understand that you have to be willing to do the things, the dirty work, the grind work that others only talk about, but you're actually doing it. So now, they almost feel, like they're short selling the team if they don't give their all. And it just creates a culture and an environment where everybody gives their all. And so, like I'm saying to you, when you look at the documentary and you go back and you watch it, I'm pretty sure people are going to be watching this all summer and for, the next 5 years. But let's study it in the terms when I'm talking about business, the team structure that was put together, the contracts that these guys were under, and the environment, the 90s, the movement. And then the marketing behind Nike and the Jordan brand, and how the brand went hand in hand with the man. And he lived up to the brand, and the brand lived up to the man, and everything went, it was undeniable. It was like an avalanche. So, we have to understand that. So, I hope you guys, if you never watched the documentary, go back and watch it. It's a lot of lessons from that. But, like I said, I definitely just wanted to touch on that tonight. Being that this was the last night of the documentaries, I thought it was key to, talk about this while it was fresh from a different perspective than you'll hear on these sports networks. Now that this is over, let's get back to seeing what's going to happen this season. All right, because I want to see the Lakers win one. While LeBron still got some knees left, and hopefully they can get back to finishing up a season sometime this summer. So with that being said, I'm gonna sign off. This has been another edition of Late Night Boss Talk. Because if it's after midnight and you ain't up, then you ain't down. I'm gonna catch y'all on the next one. Follow me on Late Night Boss Talk.